And joining us today is best-selling author Emily Holloman. And Emily is the author of the book Cleopatra's Shadows. Cleopatra's Shadows, it's an interesting book, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in just a minute. But basically, just to let the listeners know, it's a book about Cleopatra and the story of the forgotten Arsinoe. And when Cleopatra flees Egypt, as those of you who know your Roman history and all that back then, during Arsinoe's childhood and their half-sister Bernice seizes Egypt's throne, Arsinoe must fight for survival in the bloodthirsty Ptolemaic court. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, thank you very much, Emily, for taking the time to be with us.
That's great to be here.
So as I was mentioning before, you and I were talking off mic before the interview started, and you were telling me you grew up in New York, and I basically grown up in the Southwest here and in New Mexico. And I guess our listeners would like to know, what about Emily? Did she grow up reading books, and did she grow up writing or basically writing a journal? Or tell us a little bit about your childhood.
I definitely grew up reading books. I would say my parents read to me since I was very, very little, and I always have loved stories and loved telling stories and hearing stories and writing stories. When I was about 12 years old, I wrote what I thought was going to be the next great American novel, but it was not, because it was like a ridiculous 12-year-old story. But I certainly came home from school every single day and worked on this. And it was, I think, about 45 pages, single-spaced, and it was on this old sort of rickety Dell computer. And I would come home every day and write and sort of lose myself in another world. And I've been writing pretty much as long as I can remember.
And as you grew up and went on from high school to college, did you have creative writing and writing in the back of your mind, and that's what you wanted to major in, or did you major in something else?
Well, I actually majored in something else. I ended up majoring in sociology for a number of reasons. I took a lot of writing classes while I was in school. But I think a lot of people feel this way. I was a little scared. I was a little scared to completely throw myself into a career in writing, both because there's so much rejection and also because it was something that was so close to my heart. So I feel like for a while I sort of skirted around it. I took, I think, 3 or 4 creative writing classes in college, but I was not ready or willing to really be like, this is it, even though that's always what I sort of wanted to be doing.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, I think a lot of people have done that where, and especially because sometimes our parents will say, you know, well, honey, it's okay you're doing this, but perhaps you should have something to fall back on. And it's interesting because a lot of the successful authors have switched and gone from whatever they majored in or wherever they've started out to become successful writers. John Grisham, Robin Cook, Tess Gerritsen, other people like that who have gone on. And you majoring in sociology, I guess, you know, you've always been interested in people. So what about research for this novel?
I mean, I definitely have always been, and that is often what I would say when people ask me why I was majoring in sociology, was certainly that I've always been interested in people and what motivates people. And when I was researching this novel, what I first sort of was drawn to was this idea of how sort of Arsinoe, it's actually pronounced Arsinoe, but I think everybody else who reads it will say Arsinoe, sort of like the way I used to pronounce Hermione, Hermoine, until the Harry Potter movies came out.
Yes.
So it's one of those things that I've just sort of accepted that everyone else is going to say it in all sorts of crazy ways. And I'm sure the ancient Greeks said it differently than I'm saying it now anyway. But when I first sort of grasped on Arsinoe, it was this connection with this very real person that we know so little about relative to the fact that we know, I mean, we don't even know that much about Cleopatra. What we know about Cleopatra is all sort of through her relationships with these Roman men, first with Caesar and then with Mark Antony. And I think the most interesting thing for me to realize when I was doing research was how little is known about Egypt when Rome isn't there. And it's sort of really, I mean, we all hear growing up, oh, the victors write the history books. But nothing is clearer than when you're reading it and you're like, okay, so there's no Roman in Alexandria right now, which means we only have like second or third hand information, if that, about what's really going on here. So I think that was probably one of the most interesting things for me to realize when I was researching this book.
So first of all, tell us what the correct pronunciation of Arsinoe is.
It's Arsinoe.
Arsinoe, okay.
Yeah.
Not like Arsenio Hall, but Arsinoe, okay. And so tell me a little bit about when you started doing your research. Was it difficult to find material? Because as you mentioned, not a lot is known about Cleopatra except, you know, her conquests with some of these men and just how strong of a woman she is. But there are other stories that, you know, kind of lay in the wayside, but people don't really know much about that.
So after I got sort of a general idea from a few sort of contemporary writers like Adrienne Goldsworthy, book is really great, Anthony and Cleopatra, and I also read, of course, Stacey Schiff's biography of Cleopatra, I really did go back to read a lot of the original sources from which, you know, everyone has built up these ideas. And there is not a whole lot about Arsinoe, and certainly not about her childhood. But I think that's sort of the reason why I wanted to write this as historical fiction rather than as history, because for Arsinoe and Berenice, they will never have true histories written about them because there isn't enough information. So I think that what makes it interesting is taking the pieces that we do know. For instance, we do know that Ptolemy the Piper or Ptolemy Auletes did flee for Rome. And his daughter Berenice did hold the throne for about 2.5 years. We know Arsinoe was almost certainly left behind and Cleopatra was possibly taken with him. So it sort of becomes a question of filling in these gaps when you can't know exactly what happens. You know that certain people get married and certain people die. But in terms of the day-to-day, it is a little bit more of a blank slate. So I think that's what makes interesting historical fiction.
And tell me a little bit about when you write historical fiction and speaking with other authors, they talk about the fact that, yes, it's fiction, but you have to be very careful when you're dealing with facts and other issues because, yet, even though it's fiction, you're writing historical fiction.
Absolutely. And I think what's sort of interesting about historical fiction is also, like, you are absolutely dealing with facts. But the other thing is, if you're writing about something like the Tudor court, right, mm-hmm. if you're Hilary Mantel or Philippa Gregory or someone like that, there is really infinitely more information and more facts to be contending with than if you're writing about something that was over 2,000 years ago, right? So it's
right.
A question of, for a lot of my choices and my decisions come from the fact that historians don't agree about what happened. For instance, historians are not sure who Cleopatra's mother was. It might have been Cleopatra Tryphaena. It might have been some unnamed concubine, as it is in my version. But people don't really know. Sort of strange balance between not wanting to contradict the facts, but also realizing that the facts are not all facts. Some of the facts are malleable, which makes it a bit different than working with later time periods where you know so much more and so much more concretely what exactly is going on when.
I'd like to remind our audience we're visiting with Emily Holloman, and she is the author of the historical novel Cleopatra's Shadows. Emily, one of the things that I was going to ask you about in writing something like this, when you are having conversations, how difficult is it to, because when you create your characters and your characters come alive in something like this, tell me about the conversations that come up in your mind as far as what person would say to the other person and make it believable because you want to be in that time period.
Well, that's a really interesting question because, I mean, first of all, the first thing is that nobody spoke English in this time period, right?
Right.
So the very act of, I mean, nobody at all, not even the British spoke, you know, anything that we would recognize. So the very act of writing about people who were speaking either in ancient Greek or ancient Macedonian or occasionally in sort of demotic Egyptian and writing that in English is already one sort of level of translation. So I think a lot of the question is how do you, because on the one hand, there's sort of a tradition about making sure that your characters speak in such a way that for a modern audience, it seems correct to the time period. But that's also a little bit different than actually writing how they would speak in the time period because I'm not writing in ancient Greek. And also people did still speak in some level of slang, even though we sort of, as a modern audience, associate older time periods with more formal language. So there's a lot of balancing between that. And I guess one of the things that I came back to a lot when I felt like I was sort of getting out of voice for my characters was rereading the Iliad and the Odyssey and Sophocles and Euripides and all of these works with which my characters would have been so familiar. And I tried as much as possible to stick with the same translations, like all the Fagel translations, because obviously my characters are speaking in English, so I'm trying to keep it in a standard interpretation of the way the Greek sounds in English. So I think that that is sort of what helped me a lot, is reading these stories that they would have known very, very well. Because we're also talking about a time when people actually memorized huge swaths of the Iliad and the Odyssey and other poetic works. And I imagine that those would have a pretty deep impact in the way that you think and the way that you express yourself.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Emily Holloman. Emily is the author of the book Cleopatra's Shadows. It's a historical novel. And one of the things that it really, because I teach journalism, I teach broadcasting, announcing, voice acting, the fact that getting into character and the way the narrative, your narrative flows very well. And one's passages that I'm looking at here, it's, well, it doesn't matter what page it's on because the listener doesn't have a book in front of them. But you say, you write, "When my tears had dried and my breath returned, he told me something I remember to this day. He said, 'You may mourn your differences, but remember that the gods give mysterious gifts. There may come a time when your affliction seems an advantage, not a shortcoming.'" The eunuch paused. The lamp licked his face, but it didn't reach his weary eyes. I mean, I can see that picture, and it's like, wow, this is incredible. So, I mean, you already know you're a good writer, but just the fact that listening and reading something like that, I can just imagine seeing the eunuch telling this, saying this, and then that light, you know, licking his face, and it's just going, wow, this is, well, you did a very good job.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It's always wonderful to hear nice things. Thank you. That's very...
You're welcome.
When you started reading that passage, I was like, oh, this is the scene with Ganymedes and Arsinoe in the library. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm glad.
So a lot of people also forget because of Hollywood, because of pictures we've seen. We think of Cleopatra as Elizabeth Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and a lot of makeup on there. But then we also forget that even though she was the queen of Egypt, she was Macedonian.
People do forget that. I mean, there have been, I guess, sort of the interesting thing about Cleopatra is, I mean, almost since the very beginning of, I mean, almost immediately after her death, there were so many stories about her and there was so much fictionalization of her. I mean, you know, you have Lucan writing his Civil War in which Cleopatra appears as a character. And then you have Virgil, where Dido was certainly inspired by sort of the Roman thought on Cleopatra, which was not generally good. And then, of course, you have Plutarch, who is writing history, but he certainly took a lot of creative license when it came to that. It's not history the way that we think of it today. And the fact that she has almost since her death, or even before her death, taken on this outsized image is very interesting. It's very easy to forget that she actually was part of this. Ptolemies were part of this dynasty. They were the last of the Macedonian dynasties, which had basically been controlling the so-called known world until the rise of Rome. So she's sort of in this, it's a weird sort of somewhat imperialistic end of an empire moment, and it's an empire that was part of an even greater empire or greater set of empires. So it is very easy to forget all that. And the Romans also sort of exoticized her and worked to make her seem as, quote, foreign as possible. So there was a lot of sort of that distancing, which you, of course, also see with Elizabeth Taylor and there's not a direct line, but there's a pretty direct line from, say, Plutarch to Shakespeare to our interpretation of Cleopatra, the movie Cleopatra, and Elizabeth Taylor in that role.
We're visiting with best-selling author Emily Holloman. Emily is the author of the historical novel Cleopatra's Shadows, and it is put out by Little Brown and Company. You've gotten a lot of favorable reviews, and one of the ones that, because I like to read Kirkus reviews a lot, but Kirkus writes, and if you can kind of help us out with this, they talk about Berenice as she battles formidable odds, and the reader may understand Arsinoe less during the 3-year time period of the novel because she behaves like the privileged but naive child she is, her challenge to survive despite being written off by her entire family. Care to comment on that? Especially about the naive child and how the reader, or however Kirkus sees Arsinoe, as a naive but privileged child.
She is certainly privileged in that she is born into a family, into a royal family, and
sure,
starts the book I mean, that is an interesting, I of course think that the reader will also sympathize with Arsinoe, but I am the writer, so there's that. But
okay.
I mean, I think she is privileged in many ways, but she also is sort of undergoing her own struggles, and she does not, while she is privileged, she's also abandoned by her entire family. And though she may react in ways that are naive, she's only 8 years old when the story begins. I think that there is something interesting about watching people, even children, especially children, because they're so adaptable, try to find their way in a world that they never could have imagined. And, you know, of course, people have different levels of naivete, but at 8 or 9 years old, the world that you know is the only world. And when that world changes, I think people undergo a transformation that is not always smooth, and it's not always necessarily pretty or exactly the way that you would imagine it or want it to be. But I think it is very interesting.
We are visiting with best-selling author Emily Holloman. Emily is the author of the historical novel Cleopatra's Shadows. I think what you just said is just right on, because the fact that children are children, no matter if they are privileged or not, and especially when this child is only 8 years old, when this starts, the fact that they have to adapt to different things. And I would imagine that it would be even more difficult if you are coming from a dynasty and the fact that you're used to having certain things. But a child also can adapt to the fact that they can become best friends with a servant. They can become best friends with somebody else, regardless of how much money they have, how much gold they have, whatever. It doesn't matter what time period either. As you mentioned, children are very adaptable.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the other reviews also talks praises about the fact that, and I agree, breathing new life into these historical personalities. And we talked about that earlier a little bit when we were talking about conversations and other things that may be going on between the characters. And again, you make these people come to life.
I certainly hope so. I think the people, and, you know, regardless of privilege, regardless of time period, are people, and the things that drive society is very different, and society has a huge influence on how people behave and how people see the world. But I think that the sort of inherent things and desires and balance between altruism and selfishness, those are things that go back to sort of the very beginning of humanity. One of the things that always sort of strikes me, and I've done a lot of reading of very old texts, and especially reading and rereading of the Iliad and the Odyssey, is this idea of nostalgia being this almost like cornerstone of what it is to be human. Because the Iliad is the oldest book that, I mean, one of the oldest stories that we have. And even, and it was written later than it was allegedly, or told and then put down into writing later than it allegedly took place. But even the characters in the time of heroes are all hearkening back to this better time, this golden age, when the men and gods and heroes all walk together. So I guess that always sort of reminds me that there is this connection and this continuity. As much as things change, we still have these same yearnings for a past that was better, but that probably wasn't better. And the feeling of nostalgia and the feeling that we've missed something and that the best times have already ended. And it's obviously a false feeling, because things change, but they don't always change for the worse.
We're visiting with best-selling author Emily Holloman. Emily is the author of the historical novel Cleopatra's Shadows. In this day and age, because of social media, we have Audible books, we have e-books, we have Kindle books, we have Nook books. We have books on a stick. I don't know, just a little bit of everything. So I think this has really helped, especially some of our younger people, go to a book and read a book. And Audible, audiobooks, sometimes one of my four other authors I interviewed said, I think this is a reminder of storytelling, and it's bringing storytelling back to the art that it was once. And so it also is a big promotion for you as an author. So when you go out to book promotions, when you go to bookstores, when you go to libraries, wherever, how is this different from when you say when you attended a book signing or a book promotion, Emily?
That's a good question. I feel like most of the book signings and book promotions I attended were so long ago. My most vivid recollection from when I was a kid was I went to Brian Jakes. He wrote Moonflower.
Yeah, Redwall.
Redwall and all that stuff. And what I really do remember, though, is I remember him reading aloud. And I think it's great to have this sort of way of transmitting reading aloud to so many more people who wouldn't get to see it, because of course, I grew up in New York City, and there are lots of authors who come and read here. But that was sort of he was a very vivid, wonderful reader. And I think that it's absolutely true that it has changed in terms of the fact that so many more people listen to books on tape, which is fantastic. My grandmother, who passed away a couple years ago, she had almost entirely lost her vision. So she listened to a lot of books on tape and also had a lot of people come and read to her.
That's great.
And that, it's a very sort of intimate exchange, and it's a beautiful thing. So I think it's great that there are so many more people out there who can hear works read aloud. And yeah, but I'm not exactly sure. I feel like I don't quite have enough experience 2 weeks after the book comes out to make an overwhelming judgment.
Okay, well, Emily, our listeners might want to know, what does Emily like to read, or what is she reading?
I just finished Kate Atkinson's latest book, A God in Ruins, which I absolutely loved. I'm a big fan of Kate Atkinson. I think she writes beautifully and really emotional, both like lyrically and emotionally, and challenges the sort of very form of the novel. I'm a big fan. I also recently read Boria by Lily King, which I really enjoyed as well. I read a lot, so right now I've been reading a lot of contemporary fiction to see what else is out there and what other people are writing. But those are two of the books I've really loved recently.
Now, because this book you wrote is a historical novel, are there any authors who have written historical novels that perhaps you looked up or read in the past, maybe when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in terms of people writing right now, I am a big fan of Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell trilogy. I think it's absolutely brilliant and very, very, so well done and so well researched and overwhelmingly great. I also, when I was a kid, I read Robert Graves' I, Claudius and Claudius the God. Those were definitely two favorites of mine. And this isn't quite historical fiction. It's sort of historical fiction. Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, which came out a couple years ago, was another book that I really enjoyed in terms of taking you back to a forgotten time. Although, it's quasi-historical, since you're going to argue the Iliad is historical.
Okay.
But that, I guess, gets into a convoluted argument that goes perhaps beyond the scope of this question.
Because you read Redwall in the Redwall series, and my son did as well, I'm going to ask you about another one of his favorite books, Watership Down. Did you read that?
I did read that. I read that years and years and years ago. I loved that book. I loved all of those books with talking animals and sort of animals that had these human characteristics, but were sort of not quite, sort of had these whole like other societies in which they lived and operated.
Wow.
I do enjoy that sort of world building, the like adjacent to our own experience.
Well, not too long ago, I picked up a DVD of Redwall. And so I said, I got to pick this up for my son. And I enjoy watching as much as he did. And we enjoyed reading to each other. So I really enjoyed chatting with you, having a conversation with you, Emily. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to be with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time talking with you.
Thank you. We've been visiting with Emily Holloman. Emily is the author of the recent historical novel, Cleopatra Shadows. It is out by Little Brown and Company. It's available at your local bookseller, at your Amazon.com. It's available as a Nook, Audible, just a little bit of everything. So Cleopatra Shadows is the name of the book. Emily, again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Eddie Rosales. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.